بشرع تتصدد عنا ويا الله ارحل يا بشار ويا الله ارحل يا بشار ويا بشار ويا كذاب وتضرب انت وهالخطاب الحريه صارت على الباب ويا الله ارحل يا بشار ويا الله ارحل يا بشار ويا بشار ويا كذاب وتضرب انت
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Asher Kaufman, who is a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University and from 2000 to 2004 was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace and headed its Middle East unit from 2004 to 2005. Asher Kaufman is the author of Reviving Phoenicia, A Search for Identity in Lebanon, A History of Modern Lebanese National Identity. And his forthcoming book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict in the Syria-Lebanon-Israel Tri-Border Region. He has an article at CNN, Only Russia and China Can Stop Carnage in Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asher Kaufman.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And clearly the, I don't know that it is a turning point, but some people are saying now this massacre in Hula is a turning point, not as if Assad or the Assad clan have not been murdering civilians now for over a year. Do you think it's a turning point?
Well, time will tell. We don't know yet. There are some moves in the diplomatic arena. European countries have expelled the Syrian ambassadors from their capital, so we will see. I think the big issue, as I've said in my article, as I've written in my article, the big issue is how Russia and China would respond to this new challenge.
Well, Russia has already changed its position a little, has it not, by joining in the UN Security Council's condemnation?
Yes, this is true. Yeah, despite the fact that that condemnation did not really point any finger to any of the sides, and I think it reflected Russia's pressure to draft this resolution in a way that the Assad regime would not be blamed for the massacre.
Well, Russia, of course, has instigated the so-called Annan peace plan, and it's pretty clear that this massacre is a gross violation of the peace plan. Do you know how the Russians are rationalizing this?
As far as the Russians are concerned, they've stated it publicly. The two sides are committing gross violations of human rights, and therefore the regime should not be singled out in the critique, but rather the opposition should face the same critique. And the solution for the problem in Syria is not removing this regime or Bashar al-Assad, but actually working with Bashar al-Assad towards some political change. But it is very difficult for me to see how that would be possible. Because right now, this may have been possible a year and a half ago. It is definitely not possible right now. The opposition, and rightly so, would like to have an entire overhaul of the political system. That cannot take place while this regime is still in place. So the Annan plan, despite the fact that it has good intentions, and indeed it is the only plan, a political plan, out on the table right now, but I cannot see it evolving positively towards the resolution, because the bottom line is that as things have deteriorated in Syria in the last year and a half, I don't see any possibility for a resolution that will incorporate the regime as it is today with its power structure in Syria and have any kind of political resolution that would put an end to the violence.
Well, Asher Kaufman, this regime has been in power for almost 50 years, and it has employed these tactics before with the massacre in Hama, where they shelled a city and killed up to 20,000, the estimates are, civilians. And it's maintained its hold through ubiquitous secret police and these independent militias, the Shahiba militias, and now it's been at war with its own people for a year and a half. It's just ratcheted up methods already in place. It believes, surely, that They are this is their own private plantation, if you will, the Assad family, and they're going to kill people, and that's been the MO, to kill people to keep them in line, either intimidate them or kill them. But I've not seen any evidence that they've ever wanted to compromise, wanted to have any real reform. So why are we kidding ourselves?
Actually, we are not. I mean, if you observe the events as they have been unfolding, and if you are not a politician or a diplomat, then you clearly see the situation as you have just described. But diplomats and politicians have different agendas, and they have to play a different game to what they are seeing. And therefore, what you see in the UN is a sort of a diplomatic game that all parties are being involved in, despite the fact that I think most observers would be able to tell you that it probably would not lead to anything constructive, positive. As you've said, the Assad regime has been in stronghold of the country over 40 years, and right now it's fighting for its own survival. It's even physical survival, survival of Assad and his family, and it's political survival of the entire political system. And when you fight for one's survival, then you do certain things that we can see now happening in Syria.
Tell me about, though, what's your explanation for the apparent paralysis? And I suppose in many ways it's fair to describe the position of Israel and the United States in this vis-a-vis Syria as one of ambivalence, because my understanding is that nobody's seriously arming the rebels. Maybe the Qataris and the Saudis are, but not on any scale that would ever match the Syrian military. It seems as if the United States is leery of what might follow Assad, assuming that it's not a protracted civil war. And it equally seems that Israel is kind of ambivalent about the idea of the Muslim Brotherhood coming into power. What's your understanding of both the U.S. and Israel's position?
I mean, I think Israel should be singled out from the American position here, because no matter what Israel does now with regards to Syria, it would be a problem for Israel. And no decent Syrian person, opposition person, would accept aid from Israel. That would be basically a
kiss of death.
Kiss of death to any opposition force in Syria. So Israel should really, I think Israel leaders understand that, and there is a great anxiety in Israel about as to what would come out of this civil war that has been evolving in Syria, because Israel, all in all, has been comfortable, convenient for Israel to have the Assad regime. I mean, the Golan Heights have been the most quiet front line of Israel since the 1973 war, and who knows what would happen if Assad falls. As for the United States, there are domestic issues here in the U.S. that I'm sure the Obama administration is grappling with. And there is no appetite for another front in the Middle East. Upcoming elections clearly play a very important role in the decisions about what to do in Syria. And I think if the United States opens another front in the Middle East, in Syria, that would have repercussions on the elections. And Obama definitely is not interested in that. So what is left to do is more political pressure, diplomatic pressure, maybe tightening the sanctions, pressuring other U.S. allies to exert more pressure. But nobody is talking about, a military intervention here.
Well, what is Mitt Romney talking about then when he said yesterday that the President Obama's lack of leadership has resulted in a policy of paralysis that has watched Assad slaughter 10,000 individuals?
He is thinking about the presidential seat that he would like to sit on in the next year. I mean, this is what is in his mind. And I think that any president, American president, with a survival instinct today would not political survival instinct, I mean, would not send American troops to Syria now. I mean, this is this would be a big mistake, again, from domestic political considerations in the United States. And Romney is trying to push Obama, obviously, to demonstrate that he would be a better leader in that respect. And that, again, is part of the political maneuvers that take place in any political context that is completely separate from what is happening, you know, on the ground in reality.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Asher Kaufman, Professor of History and Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. The it's a little puzzling, though, in the sense that I've seen videotape of a lot of the Free Syrian Army and the opposition people and some of the rappers that have had these songs that have been viral on the internet against the Assad regime. And one of the refrains often is that Assad, you know, you've sold us out. As you mentioned, the Golan Heights have been quiet between Israel and Syria, and that Israel's had a very workable relationship with Syria. A lot of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Syrian opposition, accuse Assad of having sold out to Israel and being, in effect, in complicity with Israel. So that surely bodes for a change of attitude if the Brotherhood replace the Assad regime.
Well, I mean, whoever would replace the Assad regime, they'll have to take into consideration Syria's interests. And I don't think Syria's interests would change much with a different regime. I think Syria would still want to get the Golan Heights back. Syria would still have interests in Lebanon. I mean, Syria has been involved in Lebanese politics before Assad came to power, before Hafez al-Assad came to power. And that would stay, I think, after Assad falls, if and when. So whoever comes to replace this regime would still have to deal with the unfinished business of Israel holding the Golan Heights. And if it would be the Muslim Brotherhood or any other political organization, political figures, this is what they would like to get, what they would want to get from Israel, getting back the Golan Heights. And that will not change. As far as the Muslim Brotherhood's critique of Assad, you know, this is a very famous, this is a very familiar critique that the Assad family, Hafez and Bashar, his son now, have basically let Israel keep the Golan Heights because they understand that, you know, in the power dynamics, asymmetric type power dynamics between Israel and Syria, they cannot really get the Golan Heights by force. So they used Lebanon for decades as a way to put pressure on Israel, knowing that a direct confrontation in Israel is impossible in the power dynamics or the power structure between Israel and Syria today.
So is there some differences then between the U.S. policy, not that it's easy to figure out what the U.S. policy is, and the Israeli policy? Because just looking at it in a cursory way, you would think that since Israel and particularly the Netanyahu government have made it abundantly clear that they consider Iran and the Iranian regime an existential threat to the state of Israel, and that they and Netanyahu seems to be spending most of his time talking about the dangers of Iran and the dangers of Iran with a nuclear weapon and threatening some kind of preemptive strike. So there's no mystery about that. So how come Israel is not helping undermine this regime in Syria that's the only foreign policy asset, along with Hezbollah, that the Iranians have? I mean, I don't get it.
I mean, as I said, I mean, there are, I would say, two reasons, one tactical and the other political. The political is very clear that for the opposition to succeed, they should distance themselves from Israel.
This is, yeah, I think that's very abundantly clear. Yeah,
this is very clear. Practically, I mean, you could think about Israeli shipments of arms to the to the Syrian opposition, but I cannot see it really happening. There is a higher likelihood that it would come from Europe, or that it would be at least implicitly supported by the United States, but the arms would not come from Israel. So the best thing for Israel, and I think this is what the Israeli government is doing right now, is just watch, observe, and wait for the outcome. And nobody really knows what the outcome would be. It is simply impossible to know.
So in terms of then people that are actually doing something in support of the Syrian opposition, then it's basically only Qatar and the Gulf and Saudi Arabia, and it's difficult to see exactly what they're doing. Turkey's clearly giving sanctuary to some degree.
Yes.
I would think that the border that's open for smuggling through would be the Jordanian border. I don't know the extent of what Jordan's involved. What's your understanding of who is actually helping the Syrian opposition?
Well, the Syrian opposition has strong support in Lebanon, and indeed arms are being smuggled from Lebanon to Syria. This has been now the place, the route of smuggling, which is an interesting historical anecdote, because for decades the smuggling routes were the exact reverse. Arms were smuggled from Syria to Lebanon, and now this is the reverse direction. Money comes probably from some of the Gulf states, and this is for the most part how the Syrian opposition today arms itself. It is possible that it also happens through the Turkish border, maybe the Iraqi border. I am not sure about that, but I know for a fact that it does happen through Lebanon. And it is not a match to the military capabilities of the Syrian army. They are better equipped, and therefore they perform better in this. Perform, of course, it's a difficult word to use, but they simply do better in this armed struggle against the opposition.
Well, but they not only are the opposition completely outmatched militarily. It seems that the actual killing is done by the militia that they form, the Shabiba, the ghosts, I believe the word is in Arabic,
yes.
And that these are hired thugs, prison guards, etc. A lot of them are paid bounties, and they were apparently the ones that did the actual slaughtering in Hula.
Yes, these are the reports that are coming out, that the majority of the killing actually were done by these armed militias. And, I mean, this is another demonstration of the fact that what we are witnessing is a civil war.
But it's not a civil war between two sets of tribes or population. It's a civil war between a military and their allied thugs and a civilian population. It's an asymmetrical civil war. I mean, is there a better term for it?
This is true, but if you look at who are most of the fighters on the pro-government side, then you would clearly see that most of them are Alawites. And most of the opposition, not all of it, are Sunnis. And it's slowly but surely becoming a civil war that is characterized by these sectarian divisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, just in closing, just to return back to your article at CNN, Asher Kaufman, only Russia and China can stop carnage in Syria. So far, they haven't. Russia seems to be sending somewhat mixed signals. Apparently, Putin has ordered an arms ship that's been shipping arms, been unloading arms in Syria to go back to sea. It's difficult to know whether Putin responds to public opinion. I believe that Russian public opinion is in many ways against what's happening in Syria. At least amongst the kind of people that don't follow the regime propaganda. I don't know how much they count. And China seems to be maintaining its position. So when you say in your article only Russia and China can stop the carnage in Syria, what do you think it's going to take for them to act?
I think further pressure from from the international community. I mean, in part, this European concerted effort by expelling the Syrian ambassadors, I think it is directed to Russia and China as much as it is directed towards the Assad regime, because I am hoping that time would come and both Russian and Chinese leadership will understand that, I mean, there is so much pressure on them internationally that they must take a stand, and that this stand cannot be this impartiality that seemingly they have held so far, where they didn't actually put the blame on any side, but spoke about a resolution that would, in fact, would leave Bashar al-Assad in power. So my hope that would be that enough pressure would be exerted on them that they would simply lift their support from Assad, and I think that could be the tipping point that you mentioned at the beginning of our interview.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Asher Kaufman.
Thank you for this interview.
Again, I've been speaking with Asher Kaufman, who's a professor of history and peace studies at the University of Notre Dame. Prior to that, he taught at Hebrew University, and from 2000 to 2004, he was a research fellow at the Harry S. Truman Research Institute for the Advancement of Peace and headed its Middle East unit from 2004 to 2005. He's the author of Reviving Phoenicia, The Search for Identity in Lebanon, A History of Modern Lebanese National Identity, and his forthcoming book is Contested Frontiers, Cartography, Sovereignty, and Conflict at the Syria Lebanon-Israel tri-border region. He has an article at CNN, Only Russia and China Can Stop Carnage in Syria. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment.